This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in تخفوا ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء قدير يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما عملت من سوء تود لو أن بينها وبينه أمدا بعيدا ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف بالعباد صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories. The head of the UN nuclear watchdog is in Iran ahead of Tehran's deadline to block snap inspection of its nuclear sites in response to U.S. sanctions. The UN condemns Myanmar's military junta for crackdown on anti-coup protesters after two people were killed during Saturday's protests. Also in the headlines, French officials hint at tightening curfews and partial lockdowns due to a surge in the number of novel coronavirus cases in France. Welcome to the program. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency has arrived in Iran for talks on the eve of Tehran's deadline for U.S. sanctions to be lifted. Rafael Mariano Grossi was received in Tehran by Iran's ambassador to the IAEA, Kazem Gharib-Abadi, and spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Behruz Kamalbandi. Grossi says he is seeking a solution for the agency to continue its verification work in Iran. The country's parliament passed a law in December that requires the government to block IAEA's snap inspections from February the 23rd, among other measures, if U.S. sanctions are not lifted by then. Iran and the U.S. are locked in a standoff over salvaging the 2015 nuclear deal, with both sides calling on the other one to act first. Political analyst Eve Angler says the Biden administration should first lift sanctions against Iran, and then Tehran will fully comply with the 2015 nuclear deal.
I don't even really think this is about a negotiation between Washington and Tehran. I think it's just a matter of the Biden administration doing what it said it was going to do and returning to the JCPOA, which is really about lifting sanctions on Iran. Obviously, Iran is not going to comply with inspections and measures. It shouldn't be complying with inspections and measures based upon having sanctions lifted. So this is really a matter of it's in the Washington's court. I think the Biden administration should begin the process of lifting sanctions, and I think that Iran will respond in kind.
Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says the U.S.'s so-called maximum pressure policy against the Islamic Republic has failed. Araghchi stressed that the U.S. will become a JCPOA party again after it lifts sanctions, and the conditions existing before Washington's pullout from the nuclear deal prevail. Araghchi said Tehran is studying the European Union's proposal to hold an informal meeting of 4+1 with the United States and Iran and will respond to it in the future. Regarding Iran's deadline to block snap inspections of its nuclear sites, Araghchi said the UN watchdog's surveillance ability will be reduced by up to 30% if anti-Iran sanctions are not lifted. He reiterated that the measure does not mean Iran withdraws from the JCPOA. Yemen's Ansarullah movement says the battle for the province of Ma'arib is part of a national campaign to liberate the country from Saudi-led aggression and blockade. Ansarullah spokesperson Mohammed Abdesalam stressed that Yemeni people are determined to continue their resistance until every inch of their country is liberated. Ma'arib has been the scene of heavy fighting over the past weeks. Ansarullah forces and allied army units have been pushing against former regime loyalists backed by Saudi Arabia. The Daesh terror group has openly confirmed fighting alongside Saudi-backed mercenaries in Yemen. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on its southern neighbor in March of 2015. The kingdom and its allies have also imposed a blockade that has hampered delivery of aid supplies to Yemen. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have once again condemned the recent normalization of ties between some Arab states and the Israeli regime, Ruba Shabit reports.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip held a press conference aimed at expressing the refusal of the recent normalization of ties with Israeli regime. The conference comes as a code of ethics for Palestinian journalists and media institutes to stress the rejection for normalizing ties with Israel.
We condemn the recent normalization of ties with Israel. We held this conference as a code of ethics for journalists and media institutes to reveal the Israeli violations and normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. The normalization of ties remains a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
A number of Palestinian leaders, activists, and journalists attended the conference and condemned establishing Israeli relations, stressing that no deal can bring peace to Israel in the West Asia. Palestinian journalists and activists added that media has a significant role in conveying the true image of the inhumane Israeli regime and refused any normalization of ties with Israel in terms of media.
Normalizing ties with Israel is a way to justify the inhumane nature of Israel. The recent normalization of ties with Israel is a betrayal of the Palestinian cause, and we won't accept any recognition of Israel at the expense of Palestinians.
Palestinians call on Arab and Muslim nations to end these normalization of ties with Israel that aims to demolish the historical Palestinian cause.
Palestinian activists are all united to say that normalization of ties with Israel is a betrayal of all Palestinians. Media should stand against these attempts to demolish the Palestinian cause. All Arabs and Muslims should stop recognizing Israel as a state.
So far, a number of Arab states have normalized their ties with Israel, including the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. The move has sparked harsh criticism among the Muslim nations. Palestinians here stress they strongly refuse to recognize Israel and reject the normalization of ties with the Tel Aviv regime by certain countries. They say the resistance is ongoing and no deal can bring peace to Israel at the expense of Palestinians. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
The United Nations has condemned Myanmar's military junta for deadly crackdown on anti-coup protesters in the country. UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, called unacceptable the use of lethal force, intimidation, and harassment against peaceful demonstrators. The condemnation came after Myanmar's security forces used live ammunition to disperse protesters on Saturday. Volunteer emergency services said two people were killed and at least 20 injured in the city of Mandalay. The Southeast Asian nation has been the scene of street protests since the military seized power on February the 1st and detained civilian leaders, including Aung San Suu Kyi. Three protesters have been killed and over 500 detained since then. The UN warns that Ethiopia's conflict hit Tigray region faces, quote, a very critical malnutrition situation. In a report, the UN humanitarian agency says the situation is expected to deteriorate as households are limited to fewer meals every day. The report says a large portion of the nearly 6 million people in that region remain out of reach for aid. According to the report, this has led to severe acute malnutrition among children at sites, bureaucratic obstacles, and the presence of various armed actors as impediments to aid delivery. Tigray has witnessed intense fighting between government troops and forces loyal to the regional governing party over the past 3 months. Fugitive leaders accused the government of looting and burning of crops to force them into surrender. The week-on-week number of new coronavirus cases in France has risen for a third consecutive day. On Saturday, France reported more than 21,000 new COVID-19 cases with over 180 deaths. The French health minister has expressed concern over the surge, saying the government would decide on tightening curfews or partial lockdowns. Meanwhile, in the UK, the COVID-19 death toll topped 120,000 after confirming 445 more fatalities. The country has so far reported some 4.1 million cases. The UK has suffered the deadliest outbreak in Europe. It is followed by Italy, which has registered nearly 2.8 million cases and over 95,000 deaths so far. Number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in the U.S. has surpassed a dramatic milestone of 28 million. According to Johns Hopkins University, the U.S. has so far logged over 497,000 COVID-19 deaths. Despite vaccination programs underway, the U.S. remains the world's worst-hit country by the pandemic in terms of both cases and deaths. Elsewhere in the Americas, Brazil reported more than 1,200 new coronavirus deaths to raise its overall death toll to nearly 246,000. That is the second highest worldwide, as you may know. Number of infections in the South American nation is now approaching 10,140,000 after the country reported some 57,000 new cases. Let's get you back to the United States, where a stunning 45 million Americans have student loans, with the average debtor owing nearly $40,000. New President Biden has just rejected calls for major student debt relief, prompting an immediate backlash. Ramin Mazohiri is in Chicago.
In the United States, a university education is so expensive that it is the second biggest cause of debt, exceeding both credit card and auto loan debt. Only mortgage debt generates a greater amount of money for banks. 40% of student borrowers don't even graduate from university. But in good news, half of all American millennials, those aged 24 to 40 years old, do have a college degree. However, instead of providing a pathway to prosperous employment, college is often a downward spiral into crushing amounts of debt. The average student in the United States today leaves college with $37,000 of debt from student loans. University tuition has risen 1,200% since the late 1970s. Those younger than 24, called Generation Z, face the same prospect of expensive higher education combined with national economic stagnation since 2008. While on the campaign trail, Democrats raised major hopes with talk of an executive order canceling up to $50,000 in student debt. But President Joe Biden just declared, quote, "I will not make that happen," and he will only consider $10,000 in debt relief.
Student debt is parasitic. It's very right-wing. Joe Biden isn't centrist. He's right-wing. He's always been right-wing. If this person said that he had the capability to do it, which he does, and he said he does, and he's not going to do it because it sets the wrong precedent, then you're going to have a bunch of angry people.
Such huge amounts of debt has forced the millennial class to often delay mature steps, like buying a house, investing, pursuing a graduate degree, marriage, and children. That all depresses the economy, creates more social instability and disharmony, and all the while, economic inequality skyrockets in favor of the moneylenders. The student debt crisis is seemingly a uniquely American issue, but 45 million Americans owe almost $2 trillion in student debt. The immense scope of the problem seems to ensure that the nation's young adults will keep this issue in the limelight for years, or maybe even decades, until either debt relief is granted or wages massively rise. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
Well, authorities in the U.S. state of Texas have restored power after days of outage due to an unprecedented cold blast and frigid temperature. Officials say utility operations have returned to normal, but tens of thousands are still without electricity as crews struggle to repair downed lines. Millions are also struggling without safe potable water due to frozen pipes. Officials have distributed fresh water and food to thousands of people, but long queues were seen outside churches, community centers, and in parking lots to pick up bottled water and packed food. Almost 70 people have reportedly lost their lives due to the cold wave. President Joe Biden has issued a disaster declaration for dozens of the hardest hit Texas counties, including, or instructing, I should say, officials to expedite relief efforts. Protests in Spain continue for a fifth consecutive night over the arrest and imprisonment of Catalan singer Pablo Hasél. In Barcelona, protesters vandalized shops and set fire to trash cans. They hurled projectiles at anti-riot police, who responded by firing foam bullets to disperse the crowd. Meanwhile, supporters of the singer held peaceful rallies in the Spanish capital, Madrid. Hasél was arrested on Tuesday and sentenced to 9 months in jail on charges of glorifying terrorism and insulting the Spanish monarchy in his songs and tweets. The arrest has sparked a debate on the freedom of expression in that country. Political analyst Sergio Castano says the detention of the Catalan singer is only part of the socio-political issues in Spain that have led to protests.
Pablo Hasél lives in Catalonia, and Catalonia celebrated elections last Sunday. As a result, the contest, political social contest in Catalonia, is sensible, and we can combine the situation. But there are other elements, for example, frustration of young people after a year of restriction for the pandemic, the lack of motivation and the lack of project for young people. Many of them consider that they have to go to the street and demand for reforms and for changes in the country. And at the same time, we have to analyze the consequences of independentism and the specific case of Pablo Hasél. There are different elements, and the result are these demonstrations, these protests that during the last week are affecting the political system in Spain.
World leaders at the G7 summit have pledged millions of doses of the COVID-19 vaccine to poorer countries. However, this has been slammed as just another publicity stunt. The reality is that vaccine rollouts in the world's top economies are in overdrive, but it might take years for poorer nations to get their share. Campaigners say they want hard facts on how many doses are to be delivered and when.
The scramble for vaccines has exposed global inequality yet again. Rich economies, including the US, EU and the UK, have collectively secured more than double the amount they need, 3 billion doses, and administered 75% of the vaccines actually in existence. But in dozens of countries, no one has been vaccinated.
We are more than a little bit concerned that there is or is to be hoarding and price gouging, as well as undue preference in some quarters. This being so, we at CARICOM have recently called upon WHO to immediately convene an international convention of the world's people's representatives to commiserate, explain, assist, and commit to a fair sharing of the available vaccine resources for the benefit of all humankind and not just the privileged, well-heeled few.
Accused of hoarding, world leaders at the G7 summit Friday tried to stave off criticism by making more pledges. The UK has boasted about leading the world out of the pandemic, but Boris Johnson says the UK comes first, and spare doses will only be given away once all British adults have got the jab. The projection for that is July. US President Joe Biden also used the G7 summit, his first international meeting, to redeem Washington's reputation as the largest contributor to organizations like the World Health Organization. Geopolitics is at play here. Russia and China have emerged as major vaccine suppliers, but the EU has been accused of failing to execute a fair and even rollout, forcing nations to look elsewhere for supplies. China and Russia have already shipped tens of thousands of doses of their COVID-19 vaccine to developing and underdeveloped countries as well. Meanwhile, the US has stopped short of donating from its own massive supply. Amnesty International says rich countries do themselves no favors by hoarding. In the end, if not enough people are immunized, the virus will have free range to mutate and outsmart the vaccines. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today.
and exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
What's made Winter Storm Uri especially fatal in Texas is not only the arrival of an unprecedented cold spell, but the way the weather event is occurring in the context of pre-existing social injustices like homelessness, as well as how it is interacting with the state's underdeveloped infrastructure, inadequate planning and regulation, and lack of emergency preparedness. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kenny Stansil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, A Failed State, Power Outages Amid Freezing Weather in Texas, Threaten Lives and COVID Vaccines. Stay tuned for the details, please. Much of the United States is currently engulfed in a deadly winter storm on top of the ongoing coronavirus pandemic, but the negative public health effects of this convergence may be most severe in Texas, where millions of people are endangered by lack of heat amid record low temperatures and thousands of vaccine doses nearly expired in thawing freezers after the Lone Star State's isolated and under-regulated electric grid was hit with widespread power outages. As journalist Emily Atkin explained recently, the jet stream bringing frigid and dangerous Arctic weather to millions of Americans is like other forms of extreme weather related to global warming. That's because, as Kevin Trenberg, a climate scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, told Atkin several years ago, all weather events are affected by climate change because the environment in which they occur is warmer and moister than it used to be. What's made Winter Storm Uri especially fatal in Texas is not the only arrival of an unprecedented cold spell, but the way the weather event is occurring in the context of pre-existing social injustices like homelessness, as well as how it is interacting with the state's underdeveloped infrastructure, inadequate planning and regulation, and lack of emergency preparedness.
Writing for Discourse Blood recently, Samantha Grasso argued that occasionally something will happen in Texas to remind the people who live here that we live in a failed state. Grasso explained how freezing temperatures cascaded into power outages, causing millions to go without heat and water in the midst of a winter storm and pandemic. While people began losing power, statewide outages spiked early on Monday morning after the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, the entity that controls the power grid for almost the entire state, announced a rolling blackout, estimating outages around 40 minutes long in order to keep the grid from being overwhelmed. The ERCOT, for what it worth, was born out of Texas' brainless reflex to buck federal regulation, but by that time, it was likely too late for a variety of reasons. 40 minutes turned into hours and then days, with no real sign of when things will get better. After the power went out, so did the water, with several cities issuing boil water notices or asking residents not to drip their faucets despite their pipes freezing or even shutting off the water. As Grasso noted, it would be an understatement to say that ERCOT was unprepared for a cold weather crisis of this scale. The rest of the lower 48 states used two electric grids, the Eastern Interconnect and the Western Interconnect. By contrast, in Texas, 90% of the state's residents rely on ERCOT. As Kate Galbraith explained a decade ago in the Texas Tribune, the Lone Star State sought independence from the national grids to avoid federal regulations. While Republican lawmakers and right-wing media figures have used the crisis in Texas as an opportunity to attack renewable energy for its alleged unreliability, the Daily Post reported recently that ERCOT attributed the blackouts to a shortage of natural gas due to a drop in pressure on frozen instruments at fossil fuel and nuclear facilities. The fact that Texas deregulated its power grid in the 1990s could also be part of the problem. The Daily Post added, the electricity market incentives are currently structured in such a way that Texas power companies receive more money if they don't weatherize all their plants and shut down some of them during cold weather. Notably, the parts of Texas that are connected to the two national grids have not been devastated by power outages. In El Paso, for instance, about 3,000 customers had power outages lasting 5 minutes or less when the winter storm moved it on Sunday, a local ABC affiliate reported. As of Monday afternoon, only 12 customers were impacted, occurring as they did in the midst of a pandemic. The widespread power outages in Texas threatened to squander thousands of doses of the vaccine, which must be kept between 13 degrees Fahrenheit and 5 degrees Fahrenheit. As the Houston Chronicle reported recently, public health officials in Harris County hustled to distribute thousands of doses after the storage facility lost power and its backup generator failed. NBC News reported recently that of the 8,430 vaccines, county health officials distributed 5,410 doses to five locations, including 3,000 to Harris County Jail, 1,000 to Houston Methodist Hospital, 810 to Rice University, and 600 to Lyndon B. Johnson Hospital and Bentop Hospital. The remaining doses were salvaged, the news outlet added. After the vaccine company advised county officials that the rest could be refrigerated and used for patients later that same day, Meanwhile, mutual aid and political action groups were scrambling to provide resources and shelter to people who were facing below freezing temperatures without robust city assistance, Grasso wrote. Those cities opened warming centers and shelters. Facilities quickly reached capacity and weren't safe to travel to in harsh weather conditions. Reflecting on COVID-19, Grasso said that Texas just left the rest of the country killed so many people because the leaders thought it's more important to prioritize short-term gains than investing people for a long-term gain. And through this mismanaged crisis, she added, it will kill others too. At least 23 people had died nationwide, the majority in Texas, as a result of Winter Storm Uri, according to New York Times.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The International Criminal Court has announced that it has jurisdiction in the Palestinian territories illegally occupied by Israel since 1967. This decision will allow the ICC to investigate potential war crimes carried out by Israel for the first time.
I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
On February 5th, 2021, the International Criminal Court, or ICC, headquartered in The Hague, published a ruling establishing its jurisdiction in Palestine. This jurisdictional ruling from the ICC's pretrial chamber 1 establishes that Palestine's West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem, which Israel has been illegally occupying since 1967, are indeed in the scope of the ICC's territorial jurisdiction, and therefore it can proceed with investigating potential war crimes committed by Israel. In 2019, the ICC's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, had already established through a preliminary investigation that the situation in Palestine did indeed meet the Rome Statute's criteria for an investigation. However, before proceeding, she sought the court's opinion on whether the Palestinian territories fell under the ICC's jurisdiction. In 2012, Palestine achieved non-member observer state status at the United Nations and then acceded to the statute in 2015. The Rome Statute is the treaty that established the International Criminal Court in 1998. It was formed with the objective of holding individuals accountable for violating international law, specifically war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, and the crime of aggression. 123 countries are state parties to the Rome Statute. However, Sudan, Russia, Israel, and the United States, despite signing the treaty, informed the UN Undersecretary General that they intended to no longer become a party to the treaty. Of course, the United States and Israel would have good reason to. If they ratified the treaty, most likely every single US president and Israeli prime minister would be convicted of war crimes and genocide going back at least several decades, including a majority of their cabinets. The US is currently being investigated by the ICC for war crimes in Afghanistan. And when Trump was in office, he actually put sanctions on the ICC's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, and Fakiso Mochochoku, the ICC's director of jurisdiction, in order to block them from carrying out their investigation or being able to travel to the United States. There are several reasons why the ICC, under Fatou Bensouda, has chosen to investigate Israel and potentially Hamas and the PA for war crimes. This includes predominantly Israel's invasion and brutal assault on the Gaza Strip in 2014. Codenamed Operation Protective Edge, this was by far one of the most horrific moments in Palestine's history under the Zionist occupation, which is really saying something. Israel, at the time, launched a ground invasion of Gaza in July of 2014. During this period, which lasted around 7 weeks until August 26th, a United Nations report said that the scale of devastation was unprecedented. Palestinians fired around 4,800 rockets and 1,750 mortars, killing 67 Israeli soldiers and 6 civilians. At the same time, Israel carried out 6,000 airstrikes, fired 14,500 tank shells, and 45,000 artillery shells. The death toll among Palestinians reached 2,252. 65% of them were civilians. 25% of them were children. On top of that, 11,000 Palestinians were left wounded. This is horrific. According to the UN's estimates at the time, up to 1,000 children would be left permanently disabled as a result of the hostilities in 2014. The report also said that post-traumatic stress disorder and other stress-related symptoms have increased, and about 20% of the population in Gaza are estimated to be in need of long-term mental health assistance. Among them, at least 373,000 children. Israel targeted residential buildings on purpose, with the vast majority of victims dying either in or near their homes. This was clearly a strategy ordered at the highest levels of Israeli government. In total, the United Nations estimates that 178,000 homes were damaged or destroyed, and 100,000 Palestinians were left homeless. After this horrific war, Israel then barred construction materials from even entering Gaza so that to prevent Palestinians from rebuilding. To this day, Gaza is still under siege and looks like this. Israel also shelled several United Nations facilities, as it has done in other countries before, like Lebanon. In total, 118 UNRWA installations were damaged, including 83 schools and 10 health centers. Among other crimes envisioned in the scope of the ICC's investigation are the wave of killings and brutal injuries inflicted on Palestinians during the Right to Return marches from 2018 to 2019. During this time, the Israeli occupation forces inflicted immeasurable casualties on unarmed, innocent Palestinians who were protesting peacefully for the right to return to their land. Israeli forces deliberately targeted Palestinians in their lower limbs by shooting them in their knees. According to a report by the United Nations, in this period alone, 6,100 Palestinians were injured with live ammunition and another 3,000 by bullet fragmentation. Rubber-coated metal bullets or by hits from tear gas canisters. 122 people had to have their limbs amputated. 22 of them were children. The United Nations Commission also found that Israeli snipers deliberately shot at journalists, health workers, children, and persons with disabilities, knowing they were clearly recognizable as such. In one instance, an article in Haaretz features an interview with an Israeli sniper who boasts about having shot 42 knees in a single day. By contrast, 4 Israelis were injured during this entire period. Another important area of concern for the ICC is the building of illegal Israeli settlements on Palestinian land. UN resolutions 446, 447 specifically call out Israel's illegal settlements in these areas and says that they are null and void, that they are illegal under international law. Israel has been ethnically cleansing Palestine for decades. Millions of Palestinians have been expelled in a diaspora, while millions of others are still living in Palestine as refugees, generation after generation, stateless on their own land. Israel's widespread practice of bulldozing people's homes in broad daylight has been ignored by the international community. Destroying people's homes, whether with bombs or bulldozers, and forcing them to flee so that you can bring in your own people is called ethnic cleansing. This is a brazen violation of international law. It is illegal under the Geneva Convention, and it is considered a crime against humanity. Not even a year ago, Netanyahu was still trying to push his annexation plan to seize the Jordan Valley and up to another 30% of the West Bank. After the ICC published its decision on February 5th, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu went on a tirade in which he expressed outrage and called the court's decision, quote, pure anti-Semitism. He said Israel would do everything it can to fight the ruling.
When the ICC investigates Israel for fake war crimes, this is pure anti-Semitism. The court established to prevent atrocities like the Nazi Holocaust against the Jewish people is now targeting the one state of the Jewish people.
Of course, what Netanyahu is saying here is absurd. The ICC does not prosecute entire countries. The ICC prosecutes individuals, whether they're government officials, military leaders, and so on, no matter what religion, ethnicity, or nationality they are, as it has done so in the past. Netanyahu also conveniently doesn't mention to you that the ICC's decision applies to everyone in Palestine. This means that the ICC can also investigate Hamas and the Palestinian Authority if it chooses to do so. Reacting to this announcement, Germany and Hungary's foreign ministers also came out against the decision. The German foreign minister tweeted that the court has no jurisdiction because of the absence of the element of Palestinian statehood required by international law. This is extremely hypocritical because the entire international community, they say Palestine is not a state, they prevent Palestine from becoming a state, and then when Palestinians try to obtain justice, they give them no other avenue. This doesn't change the fact that Palestine has already acceded to the Rome Statute in 2015. The United States, which subsidizes the Israeli occupation to the tune of $3.8 billion a year in military aid, so that it can shoot unarmed Palestinians in the knees and murder them in aerial bombardments, also condemned this announcement by the ICC. Remember, Israel is the largest recipient of aid from the United States since World War II. Even as recently as December 2020, in the middle of a pandemic and economic crisis, with millions of Americans jobless and without health care, the United States still gave Israel $500 million. Now, on the flip side, Hamas and the Palestinian Authority actually welcomed the decision by the ICC, despite the fact that they could also face prosecution themselves. Many NGOs and human rights groups also welcomed this ruling by the ICC. Amnesty International, in particular, said that an ICC investigation marks a long overdue step towards justice for victims and is a chance to end the cycle of impunity that is at the heart of the human rights crisis in the occupied Palestinian territories. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
reacting to the news that the International Criminal Court at The Hague would be expanding its jurisdiction to include the Palestinian territories illegally occupied by Israel since 1967 is Michael Link. He is Associate Professor of Law at Western University in Ontario and also the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. He said that, quote, the leading political organs of the United Nations have repeatedly failed to enforce their own significant body of resolutions on the Israeli occupation. This ruling opens the door for credible allegations of Rome Statute crimes to be finally investigated and potentially reach the trial stage at the ICC. He joins me now. Thanks for taking the time, Professor. It's good to have you on.
My pleasure to be here, Richard.
So, Professor, this decision by the ICC surrounding its jurisdiction in Palestine, it's received a lot of pushback from not just Israel, but Germany, Hungary, the United States. We've seen the Israeli embassies, they've been dispatching their ambassadors to put a lot of pressure on other countries to tell the ICC not to go ahead with this. Netanyahu was saying that the ICC is anti-Semitic. Danny Dunan, their permanent representative to the UN, was saying that Fatou Bensouda, the ICC chief prosecutor, should be indicted herself. So, I mean, what's your reaction to all this pushback from Israel and their allies?
Sure. It's, you know, the fundamental principle that every first-year law student learns in any law school around the world is the independence of the judiciary, that courts, once created and judges appointed, are to be independent of political influences and are to be able to make their decisions in full confidence that that their independence is going to be respected. That's the only way in which we build public trust in the operation of the courts and the rule of law. So ever since the ICC announced, or the prosecutor announced, that she was going to initiate investigations into the complaints coming to her office with respect to alleged war crimes, not only by Israel, but also by Palestinian armed groups as well, in Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem, there has been a concerted pressure on the court. This reached its apex last year when the United States said it was going to ban the travel to the United States of any International Criminal Court officials. It's astounding to me in this modern day and age that the prosecutor and judges and staff of an independent international court would be under threat of arrest by a leading Western democracy, and the attention is not on the country or the groups who are alleged to have committed war crimes. This seems to have turned international criminal justice upside down.
And could you maybe tell us what are some of the consequences that Israeli officials or Palestinian officials could face if they're maybe charged or convicted? Because travel is obviously one of them. You know, they're afraid to travel to countries that are a party to the Rome Statute. What are some of the other obstacles or consequences they could face as a result of this?
Sure. One big one, obviously, is the fear of arrest. The practice of a court in other proceedings has to been to create, if you like, hidden indictments, which are then sent to all members of the state members of the International Criminal Court, and those indictments are sitting there waiting for a potential war criminal to come to their jurisdiction, by which they'd be arrested and then turned over to the ICC in The Hague. So that would be the concern of anybody who might be might have participated either in a military sense or in a political sense with respect to the commission of alleged war crimes. So the big impact will be on travel. Other impacts would be being arrested and then spending a long period of time as the guest of the ICC, either awaiting trial or, if convicted, then serving time in Dutch jails.
The scope of the ICC's ruling includes Operation Protective Edge in 2014, the right to return protests or marches in 2018, and the illegal settlements that Israel has been building. Do you feel that's an adequate purview, or do you feel that there were some other things that could have been included in there?
I don't think the file is closed as to what the prosecutor might look at, assuming everything begins going forward with respect to investigation. You've mentioned the three principal areas involving Israel, but I could imagine that there might be future complaints which may turn into allegations of a war crime with respect to apartheid, with respect to wars of aggression, with respect to crimes against humanity. So all those are part and parcel of what could happen, depending on where the prosecutor goes and what facts are revealed to him or to her.
Isn't there a glaring double standard going on here? Because, you know, the Israelis are arguing that Palestine can't be considered under ICC jurisdiction because it doesn't possess key elements of effective territorial control. What they're saying essentially is that it's not a real state, and that therefore the ICC can't say it has jurisdiction there. Yet, just a few weeks ago, we were hearing from the Israelis in terms of the COVID vaccine. They said, oh, well, the Palestinians are on their own. They can stand on their own 2 feet. They're in charge of their own health affairs. Isn't that a striking double standard there and hypocrisy?
There is a two-sided argument there where it has to do with obligations of the occupier toward the protected population under occupation. Everything is then shifted over to the responsibility of the Palestinian Authority. And where it has to do with other issues, there is a denial that there's exists a Palestinian state. Remember this, you know, the ruling issued on Friday was a relatively narrow ruling. It didn't say that Palestine constitutes a state with respect to all aspects of international law. It said that it constitutes a state and therefore has the legal personality to sign the Rome Treaty and be bound by it within the definition of a state party for the purposes of the Rome Statute. So it's a narrower definition than what some people have attributed to it. It's a technical definition saying that the PA has enough attributes of legal personality to be able to sign the Rome Statute. And so the cries with respect to some Western countries that Palestine is not a state, that's a separate issue that will come down the road for other issues. I think they're overblowing it, and when I hear that argument raised, including by my own government, it tells me that they can't be serious with respect to want to see, you know, justice applied impartially throughout the world wherever the Rome Statute would wind up applying.
So, I mean, if we're potentially going to see some charges brought, how long do you think that process would take? Are we talking about a few years here, a few decades? What is typically the case?
We're on a bit of unknown ground, but keep this in mind. The Palestinian Authority has signed the Rome Statute, I believe, in January 2015, 6 years ago. And it issued its initial complaints very shortly after that. So this has been before the court now for over 6 years. And we're only satisfying the end of the first of what are three stages: the preliminary investigation, the formal investigation, and then if it passes that hurdle, then the trial. So there might be complications with respect to gathering evidence. Israel will not allow investigators to come to either Israel or the West Bank or East Jerusalem. So all that can be done, they could go through Egypt into Gaza to be able to gather some evidence. But that, I think we would all acknowledge that's going to be complicated and time-consuming, and the prosecutor is going to have to be satisfied that the evidence that he or she has gathered is going to be able to stand up in court. You want your evidence to be as solid as possible. On the other hand, the allegation with respect to the settlements, my sense is that's coming close to being an open and closed legal question. The settlements have been illegal under international humanitarian law since the Fourth Geneva Convention was adopted over 70 years ago. That was strengthened by the 1977 Additional Protocol, and that was a centerpiece of the war crimes listed in the 1998 Rome Statute. Yes, there will have to be issues addressed as to if the settlements are a violation of the Rome Statute, which it'd be difficult for me to see why they wouldn't be found to be. Then who do you wind up identifying as the individuals to whom Rome Statute charges would be laid against? Because as we know, the Rome Statute identifies individuals, not states, as those who would be in the docket and those who would wind up being indicted. So there would be some effort have to identify the leading military or civilian or political leaders who played a significant part in the shaping of the settlements. And of course, the last issue would be the identification of leading political or military figures with respect to Palestinian armed groups to whom indictment may be flowing towards as well.
Again, the ICC is saying it's ready to investigate both sides, not just Israel. It hasn't even charged anyone with a crime yet. So it's quite astonishing to see so much pushback from this. To be frank.
To go to your point, I mean, this is one of the very few forms of modern, meaningful accountability that has arisen with respect to the 53-year-old unaccountable Israeli occupation. All of the hundreds of resolutions that have been adopted by the UN Security Council, the UN General Assembly, the UN Human Rights Council, among other leading UN bodies, there's been no steps taken with respect to any form of meaningful accountability with respect to Israel and its conduct of the occupation. Now, when Israel finally faces the prospect, still in the future, with respect to appearing in a docket to answer charges related to the Rome Statute, of course there is some worry, and I think that's justifiable worry. If the world had taken the issue of accountability seriously 40 years ago, 20 years ago, there wouldn't have been a need for an ICC process, because Israel would have been compelled by international pressure and international law to vacate its occupation and to allow full Palestinian self-determination on the Palestinian territory.
Thanks for your time, Professor. Again, great speaking with you.
My pleasure, Richard. Good luck with this.
The double standard displayed here by the Israelis is incredible, but not surprising, frankly. Once again, Israel claims that Palestine is not a real state and that therefore it cannot be placed under ICC jurisdiction. However, just a few weeks ago, when it came to Palestinians not having any sufficient doses of the COVID-19 vaccine, back then, Israel claimed that Palestine was responsible for its own jurisdiction. So once again, we